part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part. Fanboy.com.
Okay, so this is Part-Time Fanboy. This is Christian Horn with a bit of a head cold this weekend. So I'm going to try and make it through this episode, but I am here with my good friend Barry Negrin.
Hello.
Who always
sounds like this.
No, who is our resident Doctor Who expert. And we are here to finally discuss the end of dun 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 the Key to Time arc on Doctor Who. We have finally reached the final what do we call it? The final series of the Key to Time, right?
The last story,
the last segment of the Key to Time.
The last segment
of the Key to Time, known as the Armageddon Factor.
And it is every bit as epic as the title suggests.
That's so funny. I rented the disc off of Netflix because I could not really find it anywhere for free. It's really funny. I just to go off on a little tangent.
That's what we do. Go.
Yeah, that's what we do. I really enjoyed watching this on a DVD. More than I have, like, you know, the past ones I watched when they were available on Netflix, and then the last one I watched on Daily Motion, which wasn't, you know, too big a hassle. But for some reason, like old fashioned DVD, I kind of liked it. I enjoyed it. So there you go.
This was the only one that I watched on DVD also.
Yeah.
Because I was having trouble, for some reason, with Daily Motion.
Yes.
And so I got it from the New York Public Library.
Nice.
And the great thing about DVD, as I had forgotten, because I had been without a DVD player for a long time, but we recently got an Xbox, which has a built-in DVD player.
Yeah.
Is that you've got all that great commentary available.
Yeah.
It's a rich vein.
Yeah. I didn't have time to watch any of the commentary. I actually just watched the final episode like late last night because I've sort of been in and out of not consciousness, but you know, what shall I say?
Availability.
Yes, like sort of understanding of what's going on around me all day yesterday. So I watched the final episode last night, and you know, I have to say I really enjoyed this one. I had issues. I had some issues, as I always do with older Doctor Who. But I have to say that I really thought this was definitely, like you've said, one of the better parts of this whole Key to Time, you know, epic, as we like to call it here. But this is definitely one of your favorites.
By far.
Why would you say it is sort of your favorites, having been a fan of Doctor Who for so long?
Well, this one, it ties together the entire series of The Key to Time. You know, instead of it just sort of being some of the segments felt like they were treading water to just sort of get to the end.
Yeah.
And this is the end.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
This, I mean, it's a 6-part instead of a 4-part. So it might come across as a little bloated. But
yeah, definitely.
It had a lot going for it. You have Romana, instead of acting like a moronic assistant, she really takes charge a lot more.
Yeah.
She's a lot more badass, and she's a lot less stupid than she was. She really, I mean, yes, she got kidnapped. Of course, that's de rigueur in a segment. But
yes, from the 70s, yeah. Women got kidnapped a lot, yeah.
But she's much tougher. She's much smarter. She figures stuff out.
And I must say, I mean, we said the kidnap thing to be a little male chauvinist, or I guess, I don't know, the little bit of male sexism. She looked gorgeous in this.
Stunning.
Stunning. Like, I mean, we've commented often on how beautiful she is, but she's kind of back in her original outfit, you know, from the first episode without the big furry collar, but right. She's in this beautiful white dress, and my wife saw it and she's like, oh, that's a very pretty dress and very 70s. But I think in this final segment, she looks the best that she's ever looked. And, you know, that's very surface and superficial of me to say, but from the first episode, I was very much like, wow, she is stunning.
Yeah, her hair was on point.
Yes, exactly.
She also had a lot better opportunity to have close-ups on her face to give better acting. You know, you could really see more emoting out of her because they weren't running so much. Most of the shots were indoors. I don't think there were any that were outdoors.
No, I think you're right. I think this was all studio done within a studio, a soundstage or whatever. Yeah. It's interesting. I thought exactly. I think Romana was probably the best she's been since the very first episode.
Yeah.
She definitely had like some really good moments that stood out. For me, this whole Key to Time sequence has been like the discovery of Romana because, again, I'm not as well versed on the older episodes as you or some of the people I know online. And for me, before we started watching The Key to Time, I had never heard of Romana, but now she's kind of like one of my favorite companions.
She's the best.
I don't know about the best, but still one of the favorite. And not the best to me because of all the stupid stuff that she went through the past several episodes, which, you know, where she's basically kind of like, you know, you understand like Mary Tam's frustration, like I said in our last recording, where, you know, you get why she wanted to leave after a while. You know, I mean, the character was kind of like a doormat and didn't do anything for, you know, a couple episodes, stood around looking pretty, dressed in some kind of, I would imagine, semi-fashionable outfits for the time. But, you know, there's that one sequence. It wasn't the one before this, where she's dressed up almost like a big purple grape with a big hat on.
Wasn't that the Androids of Terra?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember, but Androids of Terra, you're probably right. But in this one, she definitely kind of takes the reins a little bit, kind of talks back to the doctor a little bit, like I was used to in the first episode, kind of has her own point of view on what should be done. And I thought it was a really good standout for her character.
Yeah, I agree. Also, something that this episode had that some of the other ones did not have so much of is this is very, very hardcore science fiction. You know, Androids of Terra was much more of like a medieval who's who identity theft, twins or quadruplets parallel. But this is really, this has a lot more science fiction in it.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term.
Well, what was really interesting to me is, I mean, well, we could talk, let's talk about the plot a little bit. Like this is the final segment of The Key to Time, which basically has the doctor on a quest to recover six pieces of something called The Key to Time. And this is the final episode and he's recovering them for something, for a being called the White Guardian, right? The White Guardian. And, basically because they have been spread across time and space, to keep them safe from something called the Dark Guardian, right?
Or the Black Guardian.
The Black Guardian. Yeah. I keep calling it the Dark Guardian. And so it's had him.
There's not a lot of nuance here.
No, there's not. And that's sort of what I appreciate about these older episodes is they're very sort of retro comic booky in nature. You know what I mean? It's very like,
although in the 1970s, was it actually retro comic book?
No,
was it just comic book at the time?
For me right now, it's very retro. Like, well, the thing that I've always loved about Doctor Who, and I think I've discussed this before with you or whoever I've ever had on a Doctor Who episode, is that it very much reminds me of like an old sort of Jack Kirby style comic book in that, you know, they shoot for the fences and some of the ideas are just like wackadoo, like crazy. You know what I mean? It's just like, oh, wow. And they just embrace like the sci-fi or science fantasy aspect of the whole thing. And this one was really great because it really tapped into sort of one of my childhood teenage fears, which is like Armageddon, like nuclear war. And it's something that I very much liked in the first episode. You know, you basically the Doctor and Romana arrive on a planet or
Atreus.
Atreus, and Atreus is at war with another planet called Zeos.
Yes.
And they are in the middle of what seems to be a continuing nuclear weapon exchange, where they've basically decimated each other's planets, and are sort of at the. It seems like they're sort of towards the end of their conflict, correct?
Because nothing seems to be left.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Although it also looks like, from where, since we're on Atreus, Atreus has been getting a pasting.
Yeah.
And it looks like Zeos has been kicking its ass for a while.
Yeah.
So they're reduced to like the last six ships. You know, there's rubble everywhere. There are no-go zones in the capital city because of too much radiation. Everyone's walking around with, you know, these rad badges to make sure that, oh, you know, you can't go here. Too much radiation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's something that very much I sort of tapped into, because that was and continues to be. I still, every once in a while, very rarely, will have nightmares about nuclear.
Well, you and I both sat through when we were kids the day after on TV.
I was not allowed to watch it. I was
really?
Not actually. No, yeah, I only watched it when it came on to the... when it came on video, and I watched it at a friend's house. And
so I'm a little older. I was born in 1969.
Okay, yeah, you're a little older.
So I was 14 when it came on.
Yeah.
And so, but I was, you know, already, well, I'm getting into that point in my life when I'm 14, so I'm a wise-ass teenager.
Sure.
when I know everything. And I was terrified for days. I had nightmares about this for easily weeks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like in the middle of the night, I'd wake up, and we've been vaporized. I'm like, oh, shit, what was that? It's like, oh, yeah, that's that stupid movie again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really funny because I think it's very hard for younger people today, maybe even in their 20s, to realize, like, well, I mean, people have sort of grown up with this boogeyman of terrorism now these days. But for us, and maybe even since, like, the 50s, 60s, you know, since Hiroshima, you know, there was always this big thing of like nuclear war. Like, is it going to happen? And as things crept towards the 80s, there was definitely this sort of feeling in society that at some point, you know, deterrence kept like becoming a big thing and more bombs and more bombs.
Oh, for Christ's sake, at this point, both the U.S. and then the USSR had enough nuclear weapons to destroy the entire planet tens of thousands of times over.
Yeah, and we still do. And but it's
But now it's only like hundreds of times over.
Yeah, yeah. But I don't think that people realize like how much this hung over society and how much of the propaganda, you know, through the news, through the government, was just like, oh man, like it was a thing to worry about. Nowadays, I don't think that that is like as big a thing. I think, but in any case, this episode tapped into that like hardcore.
Well, and you also had continuing, I think basically every episode of Doctor Who that focuses on war, which is many of them. You know, Britain suffered a lot through World War II.
Yeah.
This was only about 35 years after the conclusion of that. So you have this very classic British Churchillian weariness of World War II.
Yeah.
You've got this stiff upper lip marshal who says, we must persevere to the end and crush our enemies. Meanwhile, the population that we did see, which we didn't see much, we're all sitting, sort of lying there in the hospital, being tended to by the top physician, Merak. They're like, ugh, when is this shit going to be finished?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
you know, and then you have the dichotomy between the marshal of Atreus, who's trying to wage this war against Zeos, and the princess of Atreus, played admirably, although a little sort of wanly and a little ethereally, by Lala Ward.
Yes.
As a pacifist, saying, we've got to just get in touch with the Zeons. Maybe we can just achieve a peace if we just talk to them.
Yeah. Princess Astra, perfect name. Like, if that isn't like sort of like a weird, almost Disney-esque sort of, and the actress herself, very well cast, because I was like, hey, she looks like a princess to me. She looks very sort of aristocratic. Yeah, very. And again, you mentioned the marshal. Like, this is the guy that's sort of in charge of the military on
Atreus.
Atreus. And the thing that, another thing, going back to the costumes, like, I really love the design of the Marshal's outfit. I love the design of Princess Astra. There was sort of a, again, to use the term, not overuse the term, retro 50s sort of Flash Gordon touch to all their costumes. And I loved it.
The Marshal was very evocative of Ming the Merciless.
Yeah.
Although we learn later in the show why he has to have that high neck collar.
Yeah.
It's not just a fashion choice. It's a plot device.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. You definitely get into the Marshal, who is, for all intents and purposes, I mean, Princess Astra, she's royalty, but she's not really in charge of anything. She seems to be, it's interesting. You seem to sort of get this notion especially today, creeping into maybe British society, that the monarchy is basically just like a useless figurehead. She wants to engage in peaceful negotiations with the other planet, but you definitely know that the Marshal is in charge, and the Marshal is all about blowing shit up.
It's true.
He is all about just taking it to the end, and I don't care what happens to my forces. And he is the embodiment of sort of the industrial war machine complex, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I mean, he, even when it's presented to him that the odds are overwhelming and useless, and later on that the war is over, it's like, forget that. I'm blowing this place up.
Yeah, exactly.
Turn that off.
Yeah. And the Marshal ends up being like, at first he's sort of a very compelling character, but by second or third episode,
he's kind of a dick.
Not even just a dick, but sort of kind of an odd clown, in my opinion, because he starts doing this thing where, and at first you don't understand it, and it's just like really weird, where he stares into this like warped mirror and kind of like talks to himself, or like will just zone out in front of the mirror. So you've got this like sort of Star Trek control room, almost like a big bridge that sits. What's that?
We'll talk about the bridge in a minute. I want you to finish your thought, but you reminded me of something.
Well, it's just really funny because there's this bridge, and then there's sort of like an alcove off to the side.
It's ready room.
Yeah. Well, it's not even a room because it's not private. Like, people can just like walk off. To me, it reminded me very much of sort of those Star Trek toy sets that you had as a kid, and you would open them up. And it was like, you know, you would open it up and it didn't have enough room for everything. You had the bridge. And so there would be like the transporter, like off to the side. And you were like, the transporter was never like that, you know, like, So it was like this little alcove jammed in there where you would just go and stand for like minutes at a time, staring into the mirror until his assistant, I can't remember the character's name, like second in command, would walk over. Chef would walk over and be like, excuse me, sir, we have, you know.
Don't interrupt me.
Yeah, and then he would be like, don't interrupt me. And so he goes off for, I don't know how many minutes at a time, staring at himself in the mirror. What's that?
And often.
Yeah, and often, exactly. To the point of where it became a little, where it becomes, not a little, it definitely becomes comical. Because after a while, I was like, dude, come on, really? Like, nobody notices that this guy is, like, just standing there? Unless it's, like, a custom on that planet. Maybe on Atreus, everybody stares at the mirror. I don't know. But it definitely became a little comical after a while. To the point of where it was almost like a Mel Brooks thing, where the guy's, like, staring at the mirror and somebody comes and interrupts him. And he's like, quiet! I'm just and you're just like, oh, okay, dude. Nobody realizes that this guy's a little unhinged, you know.
I mean, it's still very British in that, you know, he's in charge and we still have to respect his authority.
Yeah.
But one of the other things I wanted to mention about Princess Astra was that you had said that maybe the Brits see the monarchy as a useless figurehead. But something that the Marshal and Astra both say is that they're not really perceived as useless as much as they are perceived as, yes, they're a figurehead, but they're a figurehead that's beloved by the people, that the people can rally behind.
Okay, yeah,
that
yeah.
They still tend to them. I just read this great play, called King Charles III. It's what happens. It's a future history play about when Elizabeth II finally dies and Prince Charles finally gets to be king.
Oh, wow.
And it's great. I mean, I missed it. It was on Off-Broadway for a while, and I'm pissed that I missed it. It's coming to BBC and to Masterpiece Classic next year.
Oh, wow.
But I read it. I read the, you know, the play, and it was fantastic. And really, the Brits, who obviously are the primary audience for this show, understand this implicitly, but it makes a lot more clear how that, yeah, they think that it's useless that the monarchy is taking up a lot of the money that the is in the public trust, but they serve a purpose to some extent, and they're sort of like the moral backbone of what makes Britain Britain.
Okay.
So that's what Lala Ward's character was serving. She says, "I must go to, I must speak to my people." And in fact, even the Marshal says, "Go speak to the people and rally them and encourage them, because they'll see you and they'll be like, yay, Princess Astra."
Yeah, but at the same time, he's got a definite plan to get rid of her.
Get rid of her, yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so what we discover is that Princess Astra, she goes to visit sort of like the medical unit or like that's being bombarded by...
Zaius.
Yes, Zaius' weaponry. And we meet the surgeon and...
Merak.
What's his name again?
Merak.
Merak, yeah, we meet Merak, and we discover that they are sort of having a little tryst. They're in love with each other, and it's very much, again, a sort of classic British...
Princess Diana.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I love you, but I cannot be with you. Princess Diana, before there was a Princess Diana.
Right.
Sort of thing. And... by the end, I think, of the second episode, the Marshal has kidnapped the princess and lured her into like a highly radioactive zone so
K-block.
That he can... Yeah, what's that?
K-block.
Yeah, so...
One of those no-go zones.
Yeah, one of those no-go zones so she can be poisoned with radiation and so he can be done with her. And
it's very classic British monarchy. How you deal with them.
You know, yeah, exactly.
You could either behead them or lock them in a damn tower till they get pneumonia.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so Merak gets separated from her and can't find her. And what ends up happening is she gets sort of like zapped by this character in a cloak who at first you assume is from the planet Zaius, but ends up to be working for dun dun dun,
the Shadow.
The Shadow, who I thought was a very sort of well-designed, creepy-looking villain. My daughter watched a little bit of this series.
Do you mean
with me.
Physically or
physically?
Because I was thinking emotionally and spiritually. We don't really get a lot of his backstory.
No, we don't get any. No, he is very much the twirling mustache villain. He is
very much.
Yeah, and he works for the Black Guardian, the Dark Guardian, whatever he's called. And he is sort of, in this series, you find out that he's the opposite of Doctor Who, of the Doctor.
Right.
He wants to find the pieces of the Key to Time to hand him over to the Dark Black Guardian.
Black.
Is it Black Guardian? Okay, Black. Guardian. And
Dark has too much nuance.
And apparently he's been too lazy to try and go track him down himself because this is the first time we're introduced to him. And he's been happy to sit back and let the Doctor do all the work so that in this final episode...
Because he knew that the sixth piece was somewhere around Atreus.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he figured he'd do the work and find the last piece, but he'd let the Doctor... recover all five pieces before them.
Right.
I guess it's kind of smart. Like, why should I do the work?
Screw it.
I'll just get the last one. But
that it sort of begs the question, how do you know you're going to be picking them up in a specific order? You know, maybe he picked up the fifth piece first. Maybe he picked up the second piece. Although I suppose eventually, once you have the first five, you've got to get to the sixth one.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think they were ever really... I mean, were they like sequentially numbered? Like this is number one, this is number two. Or was it just the order that they came across them?
You would think so. But then when, at the end, when they're discussing how everybody keeps saying, and I don't want to blow the big reveal just yet, that this is the sixth piece. You know, everybody says, oh, yeah, this is piece number one.
Yeah.
Or two or three. So there is some sequential aspect to it.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. But this guy, they meet the Shadow, and it turns out that he is working for the Black Guardian, and he is very much twirling mustache villain. Muhahaha!
Oh my god!
Thing.
I mean, even the closed captioning referred to it as evil laughter.
Yeah. Oh, really? That's so funny. But physically, I mean, there were definitely points where, because, you know, it's DVD and you have a lot, you have definitely a sort of a higher clarity to the picture than you probably ever did on TV. He's definitely got like a pair of stockings over his face or like
something.
Yeah, it's definitely, it looked like a pair of like black stockings, but the rest of it, like this half skull mask, and he definitely has like dark makeup on his face. I thought it was kind of creepy, and my daughter, when she was watching it a little bit, like kind of like moved closer on the couch. And she was like, whoa, what's this guy all about? So I thought, like, at the very least, that the Shadow was a little bit of a fun, intimidating force during this series, you know?
Well, plus he also had his, you know, monks/reverse KKK/minions milling about. And they look pretty menacing.
Yeah. Everyone's like sort of in a dark cloak. Everyone looks a little bit like the Grim Reaper.
And they're tall. I mean, one of them was a little bit taller than Tom Baker, which he's 6'4".
Oh, really?
Minus the hair. So one of them, when he's escorting the doctor around, is a little bit taller than Tom Baker. It's like, holy shit, this guy's huge.
Yeah. Exactly. And yeah, I mean, so yeah, they're sort of like a very creepy inter-. And it's funny because when I first saw one of his minions, the thing that automatically popped into my head is like, oh, is this like a dude, like a mutant, like sort of survivor of like nuclear holocaust?
Of the radiation. From
yeah,
the,
radiation. Right. Exactly. It turned out to be something different.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so what you eventually come to find, you know, she gets zapped to sort of the third planet, which is where the Black Guardian's minion, the Shadow, has been hiding out. And Zeos, you basically find out that Zeos, like, this is what I wasn't quite clear on. Zeos has been abandoned, or they're gone, or everyone's dead, right?
It seems that way.
They don't really get into an explanation, but Zeos has been executing its part of this war automatically, right?
From a war computer
that the Shadow put into place, right? The Shadow had built by this guy called
Drax. One of my favorite characters in all of Doctor Who, classic and modern. Here he is. He's this, I wouldn't say he's a renegade Time Lord, but he's sort of a fuck-up Time Lord.
Yeah.
He flunked out of the academy. He went to school with the doctor. He identifies the doctor by his nickname in the academy, Theta Sigma. And the doctor says, I don't go by that anymore. It's the doctor now.
Yeah.
And no offense. And so this guy, but he's no dope. You know, he has his own TARDIS. He has a dimensional stabilizer that he knows what to do with. But he got hooked up with the wrong crowd.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, this sort of gets revealed sort of in like the second to last episode Drax shows up. But the revelation that that the whole Zeos end of the war occurs a little earlier on. And it's kind of like a cool set piece. You know what I mean? I think it's K-9 that sort of discovers the whole thing.
Yes.
Because K-9 starts to address the
computer
as his friend or something. Or
right.
Like,
he says, finally, a higher intelligence doctor.
Yeah, exactly. And so K-9 is the one who helps reveal that this is sort of a thing that's happening. And the doctor and everyone are sort of horrified because they're like, oh my God, there's this been this whole war going on, and the people from Zeos, they don't exist. It's basically Atreus and the Marshal have been suckered in to a conflict with no end.
Right. And, well, the ultimate end game was obliteration.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The Armageddon factor, as it were, which the Doctor, I think, like in the fourth episode, actually voices the...
Says out loud, yes.
Says it out loud, which is a great sort of dramatic moment. But and all this is occurring at the same time as the Marshal is taking a ship and of his own and decided, like, that's it. Like, I'm taking matters into my own hands. I'm going to blast Zeos, like, out the whole planet out of the sky in, like, a final gambit. And
right.
This is sort of when the Doctor sort of fabricates a final piece of the Key to Time. And what did he make it out of?
I didn't get Chronodyne or something,
something
like that.
You know, he's like, I'm going to...
What's what I had lying around?
Yeah, 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 exactly. And, you know...
But it makes sense. I mean, chrono means time and dime is like some sort of material. And K-9 confirms that it's 74% compatible with the rest of the Key to Time.
74% compatible, Doctor? Yeah.
So it's like master. It's as good a fix as any.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can't remember the exact reason why he decides to do it. Is it because the Marshal has decided to blow up Zeos?
Or... I think so, yeah. They need to get the Key to Time working because the Marshal is on his way and they're on Zeos.
Yeah.
And they're about to get blown up. It's like, we need to get this thing together. If only we had the sixth piece. It's like, well, we don't have the sixth piece, but we can make a sixth piece.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what they end up doing is setting a loop in time that the Marshal is about to fire his weapons onto Zeos. And the insinuation is that once he does this, Zeos's computer will retaliate in kind, and therefore both planets will be completely obliterated. And
right.
The Doctor is doing the best that he can to stop that.
Sure.
One
of the best things about this very, very, very low-tech show that I found very compelling was the Zeos computer Mentalis. It had a countdown clock of like 10 seconds. And, you know, countdown clocks are as old as the hills.
Yeah.
Before this and since. But what's very creepy about this is that during the time loop, you didn't necessarily know what the next number was going to be. It was like 10,
yeah.
9, 8, and then went back to 10, and it was back to 9, 8. And then as the time loop was stretching, as that fake six piece was degrading, you know, you got 10, 9, 8, 7.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Shit.
Yeah.
The time loop is stretching, you know, and you don't know. It's one thing, the countdown clock, typically you know what the next number is going to be.
You don't know
what the next number is going to be. It's like, oh, shit, it's going to be 6 now. Is it going to be 5? No, it's still 6.
Yeah.
Right now it's 4.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that was sort of the genius. The thing that I really appreciated about this series was that part of what they do, they trap the Marshal in this time loop, and it's 10 seconds long. But it was like a 10 seconds until...
The loop itself was then started off as 3 seconds, but they stopped the computer at 10 seconds till obliteration.
Yeah, it's 10 seconds till the obliteration, till the final moment where they're both going to bombard each other with nuclear weaponry, and the Marshal is stuck originally in like 10, 9, 8, the right. 3 seconds of 10, 9, 8. But as the, like you said, the manufactured piece to the key to time is degrading because it's only 74% compatible, the window that he's trapped in stretches during the course of the episode. And so you get like 10, 9, 8, 7. And then later on, it'll be 10, 9, 8, 6. And it's just like a really good tension builder for the whole episode, because as you are absolutely
cheapest special effects ever.
Screen
with a big, terrible digital countdown.
Yeah. Which was probably, you know, for the time, at least British tech, you know, British special effects was probably the best that they could do. But they, like you said, they did a really good, they used it to the best effect, because like every time it came on, you would be like, oh man, like, holy cow.
What's going to happen?
Yeah. What's going to happen? Is this it? Like, is this the moment where, so I really appreciated that. And it's very interesting because, they do meet like Drax, which is funny because there's a villain in Marvel Comics called Drax.
Really?
Yeah, who's like a Herald of Galactus, and he's like a complete badass. So at first I thought they were saying Jax, and then it was like Drax. Drax has a very heavy accent. And so
thick as hell.
Yeah, thick as hell. Reminded me a little bit of, for some reason, his demeanor reminded me a little bit of Bob Hoskins.
Okay.
And
well, he said, in fact, the doctor even comments and says, where did you get that remarkable accent?
Yeah, exactly.
Brixton is like basically, the, you know, a Cockney crappy neighborhood in London.
Yeah.
I was on Earth and, you know, I got nicked for 10 years, so got to learn the lingo.
Yeah, exactly. And the actor, I don't know the actor's name offhand, but
Barry Jackson,
very charming. Very charismatic, a really sort of, it's really interesting. I wish they'd introduced him earlier on, because they introduced him, it's almost like the second
episode
to last.
Episode 5.
Second to last episode. And it's sort of like really out of left field and very not in mode with the feel of the rest of the episode. But once you sort of get used to him, he ends up.
How could you have ever done without him?
Yeah. It's definitely a character that's like, again, with modern Who, you definitely have those moments where it's like, can that person be the companion? And as much as I love Mary Tam, I was like, can we just bring him along? Can he stick around? Because I like that guy.
I have been dying to have him come back.
Oh, so he never comes back?
Not that I'm aware of. I think maybe in the books, but not on screen.
Oh, that's such a waste. You mean they never brought that character back, like, ever again?
No.
Oh, wow. I loved his, like, jogging, his sweatsuit, his, like, little
His silver lamé tracksuit.
Yeah. It's just, like, great. It reminds me of those things that people work out in today where they're, like, to build up the sweat, like, plastic garbage bag, like, right. Sort of. Like, it's great. But the guy's, I don't know if it's that Tom Baker's really tall or the guy's really short, but he's really small, but he's in comparison to Tom Baker, but
he's scrappy.
He's got a really great personality, and it's too bad that they should have really brought that character in a little earlier on. But you find out that Drax
sort of reminds me a little bit of Martin Freeman's Dr. Watson to Benedict Cumberbatch's show.
A little bit. This guy's got a little bit more attitude and sass to him.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting because he gets introduced and you basically find out that he's the one who sort of built the computer.
Mentalis,
that Zeos is using, and he built it for the Dark Guardian, but he sort of, he was forced into it, right?
Well, no, he was duped into it. He said he had a client. It was the Shadow. He thought the Shadow was his client. Actually, he didn't even know it was the Shadow. He thought it was Zeos, that Zeos hired him to build this computer. He's like, well, you know, then when I was going to get paid, I got dumped in here in the Shadow's lair.
Although, you
know, it's very interesting about the Shadow's lair, because you'd think if the Shadow was so smart and powerful, he'd have more minions running around to make sure that people stayed imprisoned and didn't just go swanning around
corridors. Exactly. It definitely seems like the Shadow was suffering from a slight lack of resources as far as, like, imprisonment goes, or, you know, henchmen and stuff.
But then it wasn't really clear, because from the exterior shots, it looks like the Shadow's lair is on a ship. But then on the interior, it's all this like rocky, dungeony.
Well, that's what I didn't understand. And to jump. Well, yeah, you see it. It looks like a satellite and they keep calling it a planet. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Unless it's sort of, I don't know, they mean
really
like
big
planetoid or, you know, some sort of like, you know, I don't know. Yeah, that kind of threw me off, too. I was like, every time they would mention it, because basically what you discover is that Zaos has been hidden by this shield because the Doctor can never find it and he doesn't know where it is. But it's sort of like the shield that reflects light to hide it. But you discover that where the Shadow has been hiding is sort of this
third
planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they call it the third planet. And to me, that would have been a better title.
Although at one point, what's his name? Romana refers to it as the planet of evil.
The planet of evil. That's great. I love it. It's so like old school comic book.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. And so you have this third planet. You have Atreus and Zaos, and you basically come to discover at some point that the sixth part of the key to time is the princess herself, which I called. Like, I knew it from the first episode. I don't know why. I had not read anything about this or whatever, but as soon as she shows up, I was like, it's either her or it's something that she has on her body. Like, I was like, she is the key to time. Like, she, something that she's got on her or on her person.
Right.
Yeah. Or she is the key to time. And
even Marek, though, even Marek figures it out.
Yeah.
On his own, which is pretty remarkable, because usually the non-player characters, to borrow a phrase, aren't that smart.
No. Yeah, well, Merrick is, he's a character that's sort of wasted too. He's like wandering around, always looking for the princess.
He loves her.
He loves her, but he doesn't really do much of anything. He doesn't really help at all.
And then he falls in that big hole.
He falls in a big hole, yeah, because he's tricked, because the shadow
has put that little black box on the princess's neck.
Exactly.
The same one that the Marshal had hidden under his big collar.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's so interesting to me that the Shadow, that's something I also was a little concerned about. All it takes is you put the little black box on the person's neck and they're under control. And then all it takes is take the black box off.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're not under control.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, and we should say that the Shadow has been controlling the Marshal. So that he'll, and that's another thing that I wasn't so clear on. I'm like, what's the point of what's going on right now? Is it just to rain chaos and death? And because he's evil, because he's basically got the Marshal and he's mind controlling him so that he will bombard Zaos, but he set up Zaos to be this automatic planet that's bombarding Atreus. And it makes no sense. Like, why?
Well, he sort of explains it a little bit. In that the war, this mutual destruction between Atreus and Zaos, and you get a little foreshadowing in the fact that the names of the planets are A to Z. And that he says that this is just sort of a practice run for the war that we're going to unleash on the entire cosmos.
Oh, okay. Okay. Gotcha. It's still kind of messed up and doesn't make sense, though. Why mind control somebody so that they'll attack a planet that's set on auto destroy? You know, you could just as well just have a planet that's set on auto destroy and the Marshal would be like the same way, right? He would just be like, well, they're attacking us. We have to.
But they wanted to make sure that there was no, you know, chance of compromise. You know, they wanted to take nothing to chance, right?
Yeah.
He was a pawn.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense, you know.
Well, you know, to the extent that the Shadow's plan was, we're going to revel in destruction and chaos. I'm not sure how that makes sense, but
yeah, I mean, again, the Shadow is very much a
two-dimensional character.
Not a lot of depth to his motivations, But I guess it sort of makes sense when you're sort of like, okay, like he's an agent of chaos and destruction.
Right.
Like what if something bad happens, he's happy with it. So
there were several I want to say plot holes that they didn't really clear up. And you know, I've seen this episode a number of times.
Sure.
Most recently yesterday. like, so for at some point, even in the second episode, K-9 just sort of trundles off into this, you know, he goes off and he gets stuck on this,
this conveyor belt
with a scrap metal. It didn't say why he went in there. It didn't say why he was stuck.
Well, do you know, it's so funny because, yeah, this is early on, and the marshal and his forces are like,
We've
got to capture the dog. We've got to capture K-9 for some reason. We've got to scrap him for metal, because if we get rid of him, it's like sort of like taking away one of the doctor's tools. That's the way I understood it, right?
Yes.
Something that will help the doctor. So the way that they seem to lure, and he gets stuck on a conveyor belt that, you know, is going to melt him along with the rest of the trash in the...
Right. But the way that they got him in there, it's like they shined...
Yeah, it's like a cat toy.
Right. Was it a...
Like a laser with a cat toy or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Like a laser... How you would distract a cat with a laser pointer is what I mean. And and it's really weird because he's just like kind of like looking
smart.
At it. Yeah.
Except for now.
Exactly. And that's the thing that I wanted to say is like K-9 is sort of like the deus ex machina of like this doctor, where it's like he gets in trouble and he runs to K-9 and he's like, K-9, do this. And K-9's like, yes, master. And, you know, and it's basically this one instance. Well, it was just kind of like badly directed too, because it wasn't like, it's like they talk about capturing K-9 to turn him into scrap or melt him down.
Yeah.
And then the very next sequence is K-9 staring at a wall. And then there's like this graphic of a thing. I don't know what it is. And it's red and it starts shrinking a little bit. And then a door opens and K-9,
and
he just follows it. They don't have like a voice like, look at this, I must follow. Like, he doesn't even say anything about it. He just follows it. So
I wonder if it was just bad editing.
I think it's just bad editing, bad directing. I just think that one moment was very badly handled, because you don't get a sense of like what that graphic...
What the hell's going on?
Yeah. What is that graphic? Why is K-9 following it? And why did K-9 become such a moron all of a sudden? Because in this one moment, he's actually acting like a dog would, which I don't know does he ever do that ever? No, not really,
Sometimes... There were a couple of times when he actually barked, but
oh, really?
I think he was just playing around.
So, yeah, I mean, K-9 sort of does have that moment. And then again, he also gets brainwashed by the shadow. Yeah, and becomes sort of his tool.
Right.
And it's a really good moment, I think, in this series where K-9 sort of like turns on the doctor and is going to trick him. And
yeah, he doesn't call him master, he calls him doctor.
Exactly.
And the doctor hears it, he's like, doctor?
Yeah, exactly. He's like, huh? And he sort of figures a way out of it and is able to help K-9 become his usual self.
His pet.
Yeah, his pet. Again.
But you know, interestingly, this scene where the doctor rescues K-9 from the furnace, you know, and the marshal, let me rewind a little bit, because when the doctor says to the marshal, I need K-9 to do this, he's my computer, the marshal's like, oh shit, we just have to get scrap.
Yeah,
and he's
exactly.
Like, all right, I'll go get him. And just before that, the marshal is being very nice to Romana and the doctor, having previously arrested them, saying, oh, now I know, because the shadow told him, you are the foretold. You're the one who's going to end this war for us. Because, you know, the shadow knows the doctor's coming. And he says to the marshal, don't kill him. You need him. We need the other pieces of the key to time. It's very cliche that, oh, you're the one who's been the prophecy.
Yeah.
So now so you'll fix this.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's early on in the episode. We're bouncing around a little bit.
Right.
But early on, they figure out, oh, like the doctor, because the doctor formulates a plan like, hey, I can make you a force field. Or he's basically trying to like scam them. You know what I mean?
Well, defensive things. Yeah. It doesn't involve killing all the Zaons.
No, exactly. Exactly. I mean, he's basically trying to figure out a way to trick them into peace. But the thing that he does say is like, I can make you a force field. And that's when the Marshal is sort of like, hey, hold on a minute. Like, this guy can help us. You know what I mean? And
right.
The Doctor does say like, oh, in order to formulate my plan, I need Canine. And that's exactly, yeah. Oops. He's about to be melted into. And that's another sort of awkward sequence where the Doctor like climbs into the conveyor belt himself to rescue Canine. Canine falls off.
And they answer that so perfectly. Just after that, when the Marshal and Shap are standing at the exit to the furnace, they're like, nobody could survive that. We're totally screwed now. And then the Doctor pops out. He's like, got Canine, we're okay. And he says, I don't know if you picked this up, a little trick I picked up from the Firewalkers in Bali.
Yeah. I did catch that, but I was like, really? Because it's just so like, I was just like, wow. Okay, because the moment itself is kind of awkward. Canine falls off and then the Doctor like reaches out.
Catches him.
Yeah, and he like, I don't even think that you see him catch him.
No, totally not on screen. You see Canine fall. The next thing you see is the Doctor pop out of the furnace.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is not the first time that the Doctor has pulled something out of his ass like this. There was an episode, The Terror of the Zygons, where he and Sarah Jane are about to get suffocated to death by the Zygons, where they're evacuating all the air from this chamber. And he says, it's like, oh, it's an old Tibetan breathing technique I learned.
I love how it's human too. Like it's some from the planet Earth. Like he didn't learn it anywhere else. But either way,
within that whole segment, the whole tropes are very cliche about the foretold prophecy. But the acting is so great. John Woodvine, who played the Marshal, he was also an American Werewolf in London. He was also in Nicholas Nickleby.
That's where I recognized him.
Production.
From.
He is such a treasure.
Yeah, yeah. He's definitely really good. He's a little over the top at moments, but you know, after learning the last episode when I did some reading up on it, that a lot of these were just like one takes, like first takes. Like it was the first time that they were uttering these lines in front of the camera. Like you did not get a second take and barely even rehearsal, you know.
It was very Ed Wood.
Yeah, they were very plowing through it. So for what they were doing, you know, they did a very good job. The other thing that I really liked about this is, you know, obviously the effects at points in time, I'm kind of astounded, don't even reach like Star Trek 1969 level effects. In this one, they worked really well with what they had, because at one point Drax and Doctor Who go Ant-Man on everybody and shrink. Drax shrinks the Doctor by accident and then shrinks himself. And they're hiding from one of the Shadow's minions who happens to be standing outside of the TARDIS.
With the door open.
Yeah, with the door open, where the key to time is. And it's a really neat little moment how they pull it off. I mean, obviously to you and me today in 2016, it looks very fakey and kind of like, but I was thinking like, I was like, for the time, you know, especially somebody who's kind of like into animation and like the history of anime, you can see like there's definitely different layers of compositing that they were trying to do, where you had like foreground where the foot is walking in front of them, and then you had the actors, and then you had like a green screen in back of them, and then you had like another one that added sort of a dimension to the background, you know, like almost like a three. So what they were doing was kind of cool for the time, I thought.
It looked better than it could have.
It looked better than a lot of the stuff that I've seen on a lot of old Doctor Who's. Like, I think that maybe after the disaster of, what was the last one with the giant squid? What was it called again?
Oh, The Power of Krull.
The Power of Krull. I think after the disaster of The Power of Krull, I think they really brought their A game to a lot of this, like with the costuming, with the sets, with the effects. You know, you had some like laser blasts, although for the life of me, I can't imagine why they only do that like burst of light at the end of the gun and not the length of like the beam, you know what
probably
I mean?
Probably easier.
Yeah, it's probably easier, and they probably didn't have to do squibs in the wall to like make smoke to where things were hitting and stuff.
But so, actually, there was a terrible fight scene between Shap and one of the mutes, the Shadow's minions, where they got the timing all screwed up, where Shap and the mute are trading fire, and clearly the Shadow figure hits Shap first, but he doesn't, but nothing happens, and then Shap shoots the mute. The mute falls down, but then Shap poorly acts, getting hit, and he goes, "Ah!" And he falls down. But that's like a minute later.
Yeah. It's interesting because there's a lot of stuff that I noticed in this particular one where I realized like, oh, like things could be not only just sped up, but made clearer because with a certain amount of editing, and obviously they didn't have the editing techniques that we have today. I don't know. These were all shot on video or film?
Video.
Okay. So they're shot on video, but it's really interesting.
That's why all the interior shots look so flat.
Gotcha.
Because it's video.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting because there were definitely scenes, I think particularly with Romana, where I noticed where she would be talking to somebody off screen and they would be talking back to her. And there's sort of like a mini gap in the conversation, like a lull where it's very much like, I'm talking to you, and then it's like second, and then she's talking to me, you know what I mean? And then I'm talking to you. And it's really interesting to me because I think obviously the sort of like early 80s pacing of like Flashdance or, you know, Top Gun, you know, these sort of movies that relied on like heavy, fast editing had not been introduced yet. But it'd be a really interesting editing exercise to take like this episode and sort of fill in the gaps between conversation that seem to happen and see if it speeds anything up or increases the tension. Because, if I was a film student, that might be something I was interested in, or maybe even in my own spare time, because I noticed that, like, I was like, oh, I don't think that it's badly edited. I think it's well edited with what they had at the time, but, to a current, you know, sort of mentality. It's definitely like, oh, this
a little
is off.
Sloppy.
Yeah, there's something off here. And I noticed it, not in a bad way, but more sort of in like a cerebral, like, huh, like this is interesting to me. And if I watch more old Doctor Who episodes, I may want to pay more attention to that because it seems very much sort of like a soap opera thing that I became very aware of, like with soap operas, because they're running through their scripts and, you know, the pace of the production is so fast, you know what I mean? That you get that sort of like weird conversation where it's like, wait, they're having a conversation, but it seems like a little off. And, maybe this could be tightened up a bit. I don't know. It just seemed weird to me, but in any case, by the end of the episode, by the end of the series, we discover that Princess Astra is like the sixth princess in the sixth
generation of the sixth house of Atreus. Yeah.
Yeah. She's the sixth princess of the sixth generation, the sixth house of whatever it is. And it's really funny because it's like, oh.
Yeah. I should have saw that coming.
Yeah. Well, they never mention it. That's the problem. They only mention it towards the end, I think, of the fifth episode, maybe even in the beginning of the sixth.
Yeah.
And so they sort of drop this revelation, which that's just kind of like not great writing in and of itself, where it's like they sort of resolve a mystery that was never a mystery, you know, as far as like they drop a clue that was never a clue in the first place.
Right.
But it's like, oh, okay, she is the key to time. An actual human being is the key to time. And what are we going to do about this? Because the doctor is like, well, we've got to, you know, turn her into the sixth piece. And the Shadow wants her, obviously, to be turned into the sixth piece. But Romana brings up the issue of like, hey, this is an actual human being. And if she a human being, which is another thing that they use. They use the term human being in this, and I was like, but she's not human. She's from a different planet. But I get what you're saying.
Right.
But you sort of end up with the moral dilemma, because what Romana realizes is that she's going to be trapped as this and not be a sentient being anymore. And this is a horrible thing that we're going to do, right?
But that becomes a major plot development later on.
Yeah. Which ends up, but the doctor decides to go through with it, and Romana's kind of pissed off about it.
Right.
She's like, how can we do this? And they end up getting the key to, because the shadow does succeed in getting the completed key to time. And how do they get it back from him? I'm having
but this is the best, like one of the greatest. This is yet another reason why this is one of my favorite episodes, because it has Drax, it has K-9. They're shrunk down and they sneak inside K-9, like the Trojan horse.
Yeah. Okay.
In fact, he mentions it to Drax. He says, ever been to a little town called Troy?
Yeah.
Beautiful spot in Asia Minor.
That's funny.
So they use K-9. They pretend that that K-9 still has the black box on him, that he's still working under the shadow's thrall, I don't know why the shadow doesn't know that, you know, his Bluetooth connection was severed.
Yeah.
But apparently it doesn't happen like that. So they use K-9. They blast into the shadow's lair where Astra was just about to reach out to the key. That turns her into the sixth piece. The shadow has both the key to time and sixth piece. The K-9 blasts a few things. The doctor and Drax go back up to being 6 feet tall. They grab the piece, they grab the key to time, they run like hell, they get back to the TARDIS, and that's what happens.
Yeah. And as they run away, they're like, the shadow's like, no, how can this very dramatic, they've escaped with the key to time.
If they just had some more minions, they would have been like, you're not going anywhere.
Exactly. Well, you know, and he has a conversation with the Black Guardian, where the Black Guardian is very much like, you have failed me.
Well, no, the shadow says, I have failed. And the Guardian's like, I knew this was going to happen. Don't worry. This is all part of my plan. Worthless wraith.
Yeah. And he basically, so this is where I was a little confused and things did not get cleared up for me, because is it that the Black Guardian is the White Guardian, has been the White Guardian all along?
No.
Or is it? Okay. So
no, because even in the beginning, in the first episode, in the Rybos operation, when this whole quest is set forth, the White Guardian says to the doctor, beware the Black Guardian, but says nothing else.
Yeah.
So the doctor knows there's this other equal and opposite guardian that's out there that he has to watch out for.
Yeah. And so basically he disguises himself as the White Guardian.
Right.
And tries to get the doctor to hand over the key, and the doctor sort of, they figure it out because Romana is still going on about
Princess Astra, right.
Like, what are we going to do about this? This isn't cool. And the doctor's like, oh, just ignore it. Kind of like, you know, playing
it
off.
State of the universe, tough.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is, you know, is it just one life or billions of lives that we have to worry about? And
the needs of the many, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. And so you have the Black Guardian, who's disguised as the White Guardian, saying, like, give me the key. And Romana's like, but we have to consider, you know, Princess Astra.
Right. And the doctor is like, he's about to, you know, say, key to time, I command you.
Yeah.
Like, basically, to go to the Black Guardian. And he's like, but wait a minute. And he says this like three times.
Yeah.
It's like he's Columbo.
Yeah, exactly.
But just one more thing.
Yeah, just one more thing. And yeah, he's kind of stalling a little bit. And then at the last moment, he's like, he denies the Black Guardian the key to time. And it's like, how did you know? And the doctor says, well, I knew because The
White Guardian would never be so callous about a life.
About a human being's life. Exactly.
Right.
That the White Guardian would never sacrifice a person for the safety of one person for the safety of the universe.
Certainly an innocent person.
Yeah.
Who's a bad guy. He's blown them up before, but.
Yeah, but which brings me to the point of like, then why would you even, because it's the White Guardian that dispersed them. Why would you even make it a person? Why would you hide it as a person in the first place? So basically, if the White Guardian gives such a shit about one person's innocent life, why would they put them into this much danger? Because even Romana, once she figures out earlier in the series that the princess is the sixth piece, she says, like, wow, you are...
These guardians are assholes.
No, she says, wow, you are an even bigger danger than I thought you were. Like, you are, like, in bigger trouble than I even considered.
Oh, to Astra, yes.
Yeah, to Astra, she says. And, you know, has this moment of, like, you are in deep doo-doo, you know what I mean?
Yes, but for some reason, this doesn't phase Astra. Astra's like, my destiny lies here. This is what I've been destined for.
Yeah. Astra's not concerned. The only person that's concerned is Romana. So,
right.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Well, I'm sure. Clearly the doctor's concerned, but he's not letting on because he's just too slick about it.
No. Yeah, and so they deny the Black Guardian the final piece. They're about to wrap up the episode, and then Tom Baker does this little bit about the key to time where it's like, but don't you see? We have power, unlimited power at our fingertips. We can go to the beginning. We can fix whatever we want.
We can do whatever we want.
Yeah, exactly. And then he starts doing this like really weird maniacal sort
the
of
eye
like
flutter.
Face.
Like he rolls his eyes back.
Yeah, and Romana's like, what are you doing?
Okay?
Yeah, are you okay? And then at the last moment, he's like, oh, of course.
All right.
I was just yanking your chain. But
could you imagine if somebody else did this who wasn't okay?
Yeah, exactly. He's like, we've got to do something. And then where do they leave it with the key to time? Is it just like in his possession or?
No. He scatters the pieces around the cosmos.
That's right.
Although he sends Astra back to Atreus where she belongs. And then she shows up. She visits Marek, who's in the hospital because he hit his head. And, you know, it's a replaying of when she's merely a hologram. And she's luring him into the hole. And she's like, Marek, I'm here. But this time, she is here. And she can be with her commoner boyfriend.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, kind of. Oh, that's right. I remember thinking last night, like, wait a minute. He just dispersed them again? Like, doesn't that make it... Like, it's just like going back to the beginning. And I'm like, doesn't that make it... Like, can't the Black Guardian just find them again? Like, this is weird. Like, I remember thinking like that was kind of dopey. Like, wait, you went through all this effort to get them. You finally got them into one piece and you're just going to scatter them again so they can be found again?
I'm not sure if he scattered if you look at the image, it looked like the first five pieces were not just scattered, but like vaporized.
I remember the graphic.
I'm destroying this piece of crap, right?
Yeah, I remember the graphic. So that's the end. We are left with the... It took us 2 years to finish this.
Really?
I think. Yeah, close to... Because we've been talking about like the regular Doctor Who episode. Not the regular,
the modern Doctor
Who episodes. I didn't mean to offend you.
That's okay.
You know, the modern Doctor Who episodes, we've been talking about like superhero shows in between, and this would just slide by the wayside. So we finally finished The Key to Time. And I have to say, you know, for the most part, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a lot of fun. It helped me appreciate Tom Baker because I don't think I've been exposed as much to this doctor in the past. So I really enjoyed it. I'm sad that Mary Tam does not return. Like, this is the end of her run.
Because I
really liked her as a companion.
She, you know, she was definitely, especially in this story, she picked up a lot of spark.
Yeah.
She was very smart.
Yeah.
She mugged Barrack at one point, so she's clearly physically strong like the doctor.
Yeah.
You know, she's She's got all the pieces. She's like, she's sort of like the proto River Song, without the love of the Doctor, without the infatuation of the modern companions. She's a badass.
Yeah.
Even in the beginning of episode one, she's the one that's piloting the TARDIS.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's interesting, on the commentary on the DVD, she says Mary Tam is actually doing the commentary with the director.
Oh, really?
And she says that they're sitting around the canteen while they're filming this, and they're talking about the Gareth Roberts, the showrunner, is sort of lamenting, you know, can you please come back? Can you please? She's like, nope, I'm done. And they're sitting there with Lala Ward, who is Astra, and saying, and he says, well, who can be the next companion? And she says, sort of jokingly, well, how about Lala Ward? She's right here. You've got her right here. And then all of a sudden, people chuckle, but then it gets really quiet. And Gareth Roberts goes, Lala Ward, huh?
Interesting.
And lo and behold, in the next episode, look who shows up as Romana.
That's what I thought, because when I looked around on the internet, I thought that the princess looked kind of familiar. So she becomes Romana.
Yeah.
And how do they explain? Do they explain that at all?
Yes. In the next episode, The Destiny of the Daleks, she just walks out of the back room as with the face of Princess Astra. This, you should look that up or get the DVD for that. Just the opening scene. It's hysterical. It's like 5 minutes long. She swans out. And he says, you can't just walk around with somebody else's face on. She goes, why not? He says, it's just not done. And, you know, he says, go and change. She goes, all right. And she comes back like three or four times as these other women. And he's like, that's not going to do. And she eventually just comes back as, you know, Romana, and or as the Romana number two. And she goes, she says, well, I guess I'll just keep this.
That's interesting.
It was.
That's interesting. Wow, I got a lot to say about that. I'm going to have to watch that or track that down. But
I think that's how it happens.
I'm going to have to. I didn't know that Mary Tam did the commentary. I wonder if she does the commentary on the whole series of DVDs, because
I'm not sure. I think so, but
now
I'm
going to want to watch some commentary, because the one thing that has that this series or watching this whole thing is that I have become a big Mary Tam fan, and I've tried to look up some of her other credits, and it doesn't look like a lot of stuff is available on DVD that she's in. But it seems like she had like some sort of like decent career as far as like acting is concerned, especially in England. I'm going to miss her as a companion, but the fact that you said that, like that they were joking around on the set and she's
I looked it up. That one of the other, like, she sort of swans out as three other women. One of whom is blue. I mean, she sort of looks like somebody from Avatar, obviously, you know, decades before there was an Avatar, but
Sure. No, but my point being is, like, you know, part of the reason she wanted to like sort of leave the show is because she sort of started seeing this character as not multidimensional, sort of just like a two-dimensional like wallpaper, you know, like in the background. And the fact that she would just go like, oh, use this person, and that they would be like, sure. Like they would just use the next actress that was in closest reaching range, you know, to me says a lot, you know, that she was right, you know, and that it's just like, okay, I'm just easily replaced. You know what I mean? That there's not a lot of respect, or wasn't a lot of respect for what she was doing, because, you know, I mean, obviously he's begging her, but as soon as she's like, oh, just use this person,
right,
you know, it's kind of insulting in a way. And
a little bit.
And that would be like you or me at my job, just being like, like talking to my boss and like, or whatever, we put in our 2 weeks notice and we're walking down the hall and it's just like, hey, just use this guy. And they're like, oh, okay. Yeah, sure. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which very well may be the case in corporate America, but, you know, at the same time, it sort of like proves your point. Like, she's just a cog in the machine, which is unfortunate, because I think that you could have developed her as that character and made it much more, you know, interesting and taken her to places, which I think maybe the modern era of Who might do. You know what I mean? Like you said, very much sort of a River Song component to that character. So yeah, then that's it. We're done with The Key to Time. Finally.
We did it. Yeah.
We did it. I've enjoyed it. I know that you enjoyed it. Because you love this series. So you're going to, because we're not going to have any new Doctor Who for a while. It's going to be a while.
It's going to kill me.
Like till Christmas, right?
It's killing me.
And just yesterday when we were watching this, my daughter said to me, when are we going to start watching the episodes of Doctor Who with the guy with the white hair? And I was like, he's not coming back for a little while. But one of the previews on the DVD was for the Donna Noble series.
And oh, nice.
My daughter was watching that, and she's like, this looks awesome. Can nice. We watch this? And I was like, well, we might have to go back and start watching the modern Who for her. I think maybe she's at the point where she might be able to handle most of it. So
she's 10?
She's going to 9.5, going to be 10. Yeah.
She can handle it.
Yeah, I think she can handle it. And I'm very excited to show it to her. So maybe we'll start watching, or she'll start watching modern Who. But in any case, yeah. Because of the fact that it's going to be a while since the next Doctor Who, you should start thinking about what we want to watch next. Do we just want to jump into the next Romana, or do we want to watch something else?
Well, you know, I'm available for The Flash and Supergirl.
Yeah, no, we'll do those.
They're
sure.
going to be doing a 4-part crossover, Flash, Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, Arrow, that I'm happy to chime in on.
Sure.
And they're also, I'm also happy to chime in on the, there's going to be a 2-part Flash Supergirl musical episode.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do the season premieres of all of them when they well, hopefully we can fit that stuff in. But in any case,
but if you're thinking of doing another classic Doctor Who,
yes.
Let me put my thinking cap on.
Well, or we'll just jump to the next Romana, because I'm very curious as to how she plays versus Mary Tam. I'm very interested in that. But you about it.
We could see, I mean, just to throw it out there, Destiny of the Daleks is next, but really the one where she shines almost the most is City of Death.
Okay.
It's a classic. It's one of the top rated Doctor Who episodes.
Oh, that sounds
one
good.
Of the top rated Tom Baker episodes.
Oh, that sounds good. Maybe we'll check out City of Death. But all right. Well, in any case, we finally finished The Key to Time. This has been the part-time fanboy episode of The Armageddon Factor of Doctor Who. My name is Christian Horn, and I am here with our Doctor Who expert, Barry Negrin. And thanks for listening. Check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I also have an Instagram. And review us on iTunes if you get a chance. We need reviews on iTunes. That would be very helpful. Thank you for listening, and hopefully we will be back soon with another episode of Part-Time Fanboy.
Part-time fanboy.